From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. For more than 20 years, Meredith Ramsey, former political science professor at the University of Massachusetts Boston, has tracked economic development and social change in two lower Eastern Shore towns. We talk with her about what she's found and with two local leaders about what lies ahead for the area.
In the future, when those individuals are educated about the political system to get involved in the voting process, we may have even more African Americans in leadership in President Zane.
Plus, the history of Baltimore's Charles Street dates back hundreds of years to a time when Baltimore wasn't a city. Tom Hall talks about the well-known thoroughfare's beginnings with local historian John McGrain, author of the new book, Charles Street, Baltimore's Artery of Elegance. First, the news.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Somerset County, the southernmost county in Maryland's eastern shore, was founded in 1666. Its motto for centuries has been Semper Idem, Latin for always the same. A lot has indeed stayed the same, but even at the bottom tip of Maryland, the normal processes of time and the struggles to bring about change intentionally have had effects also. Almost two decades ago, in 1996, Meredith Ramsey, a retired faculty member of political science at the University of Massachusetts Boston, wrote an analysis of some of those effects of time and some of those struggles. It chronicled the history of Somerset County, especially in the two incorporated towns, landlocked Princess Anne in the north and Crisfield on the bay in the south. It was titled Community, Culture, and Economic Development, Continuity and Change in Two Small Southern Towns. This month, the second edition of the book was released in paperback with updates of more changes in the county over the past 18 years. In a few minutes, we'll hear from two African-American residents of Somerset who have played a role in some of the changes. First, author Meredith Ramsey is with me in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Why did you want to write this book?
Well, I needed a topic, a research project for my doctoral dissertation at the University of Maryland at College Park.
Uh-huh.
And my husband had some work he needed done in all of the counties on the Eastern Shore in Southern Maryland, requiring interviews for his project. So I asked him if I could do some of the interviews just to have the experience. And he assigned to me the three lower shore counties. So when I went into Somerset, I could not believe what I saw, you know, and heard. It was just, it reminded me of the South that I grew up in three quarters of a century ago, the Deep South, you know.
You grew up where?
Grew up in Virginia, New Orleans, and Tennessee. I was taken aback and at the same time fascinated. I also wanted to know why economic development seemed to be so difficult there, and why the attitudes about it seemed different in Princess Anne and from what they were in Crisfield, the two towns. Princess Anne seemed to be trying hard to bring about economic development. But in Crisfield, the people would give lip service to it. But on the other hand, I really sensed a lot of ambivalence about, and I think that ambivalence is still there.
You seem to conclude in your analysis that it actually makes sense for many of the poor residents of Crisfield to focus on seasonal work, piece in with unemployment compensation, and fend off larger businesses which might pay minimum wage year-round, but which actually wouldn't benefit them individually.
Well, yes, I really did come to understand their perspective on that. And I have to say, you know, I think in many ways they were right about that because let me back up a minute. First, let me say that all of them wanted jobs for their children and for the community. They didn't want their children to have to leave to find employment somewhere else. But then the ambivalence was that they were afraid. They were afraid of the unbridled forces of capitalism that would raise property values if development took off, would raise the property values with that, higher taxes, would bring about new zoning laws, and the fear that they would not be able to afford to upgrade whatever, you know, they owned to comply with the zoning laws. They believed that the best jobs would go to outsiders, and they just didn't want to become marginalized in their own community. And they didn't, as one person put it, they didn't want to become the servants of the very rich.
Those are attitudes you're reporting from the seafood capital of the world, Crisfield,
on
the bay. And your update, in your update that you're publishing this month, you say that Princess Anne, where you found different attitudes, has actually done pretty well in the last two decades. Tell us a bit about the economy as you observed it. What drives Somerset County's economy?
Well, unfortunately, not much is driving it right now. In the past, Crisfield's economy has been driven by the seafood industry. I mean, in the, you know, the more recent past, last 100 or so years, recent past. Crab capital of the world became their motto. But all of the marine industries are fading.
And elsewhere in the county, what drives the economy?
There are small farmers. There are bigger farmers, you know, who are the people who kind of run things there. But this is the interesting thing now. The agricultural industry is in decline, and it has been for a long time. And so the white landowners, the good old boy group, as they're called there by some, they have tried to develop their land into housing developments and that sort of thing to make it more profitable for themselves. Now, honestly, they don't seem to have succeeded very well. And just to go back for a moment to something you asked about earlier, Princess Anne is, I believe, doing better than Crisfield, undoubtedly. But Princess Anne is not really thriving the way one would hope. And they've made quite a few serious efforts to bring in industry or jobs, and they just haven't succeeded for one reason or another. Most of the renovation of the downtown and the good things that have happened in Princess Anne, and there certainly have been some very good things, most of them have been done with government grants.
That's retired Professor Meredith Ramsey here on Maryland Morning 88.1. We're talking about her new book, Community Culture and Economic Development, Second Edition, Continuity and Change in Two Small Southern Towns, and Changes in Somerset County Since the First Edition 18 Years Ago. After you published the first edition in 1996, it had been many years since you had been back to Somerset County. Walk us through some of the major changes that occurred between then and your second edition published this summer.
The main change that I see is political. After 350 years, the first county commissioner, first African-American county commissioner in the person of Craig Mathis, there have been some demographic changes. There's been a slight decrease in the white population's portion of the county, and a African American percentage of the population has increased.
And what is the percentage of Somerset's population that's African American?
Well, at the time I finished writing the book, it was about 42% African American. It may be, I mean, sure, it's changed a little bit now.
What has been the response from Somerset County officials and residents to your work?
Well, the response from the Black community has been quite positive. I have not heard anything from the white community, except for one or two people who are not typical. But I have every reason to think that there were people in the white community and the power, particularly in the power structure, who probably didn't like the book at all. I mean, after all, you know, it doesn't shed a good light on them. Let me add this. The people in Somerset County are very polite. It's a very traditional society, very traditional. So I think there's a reluctance on the part of people to be really open about their feelings, if that might cause any trouble of any kind, even the whites.
I appreciate your talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Meredith Ramsey. The second edition of her book, Community, Culture, and Economic Development, Continuity and Change in Two Small Southern Towns, is out in paperback now. This is Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. After the first edition of the book was published in 1996, it had been many years since Dr. Ramsey, who lives in northern Montgomery County, had been back to Somerset County. Then in 2009, she received an email from Dr. Kirkland Hall, then president of the Somerset County branch of the NAACP, now chairman of the County Democratic Central Committee. Dr. Hall is also an instructor in the Exercise Science Department at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. He had worked closely with Dr. Ramsey while she researched her book and was sending that email to tell her that a community forum had been called. On Monday, I spoke with Dr. Hall and Reverend Craig Mathias, who represents Central Somerset County around Princess Anne, District 1, on the Somerset County Commission. Commissioner Mathias was the first African-American resident to be elected to any county office. I began our conversation by asking Dr. Hall about that community forum.
We had partnered with the SCLU, and we compiled a booklet. It was a diversity report that SCLU and the NAACP did, again, looking at the hiring processes in government and also the educational system of the county. And in order to bring it to the attention of everyone, we decided to call it a community forum. And we had several meetings of community leaders, pastors, citizens, government officials, educators, and civil rights activists came together to try to change what has been a dismal record of African Americans in leadership in government and education in our county. And from that workshop, we had a meeting at St. James United Methodist Church, located in Westover, where we had David Gian, Carl Snowden was the moderator, Pastor Mathias and others who were involved in the change in the county came together and just answered questions from the community. But the sad thing about it, some of the government officials felt that everything was okay. we don't have any problems in our county. Yet the numbers dictated just the opposite. And unfortunately, that gentleman who made that statement did not win the next election. So,
Dr. Ramsey writes about it, there's a direct link between that community forum, the challenges that came out of that presented to county government, and the next election. Commissioner Mathias, do you see it that way?
Well, I do believe that it did have a positive impact on making people aware of some of the, I will say this way, the lack of positions of leadership within from African Americans within the county. There are still no directors or within any of the county government positions. When those positions were available or open, there were very few that applied, and The sad thing about it, some were not qualified. But my personal opinion is that the mindset of many of those who are still in the positions to make a difference within the county is still the same. They're not eagerly seeking African Americans to fill those positions. Because when you look at, if you were to research the history of the available departments that were open and needed a new director, and look at who was hired, then you'll see that it's still basically that those in charge want to maintain control by hiring those persons that are related to them.
Dr. Ramsey wrote in her analysis about a promising election, town election in 1990, when Princess Anne for the first time elected an African-American, Garland Hayward, to the town commission. And within 6 months, Dr. Ramsey wrote, quote, the good old boy machine had partially reversed the outcome of the election and reestablished its former control of the town, close quote. Is that pattern something you worry about today, Dr. Hall?
Well, I think in the town of Princess Anne, there seem to be some genuine changes that are occurring. Based on my relationship with several commissioners in the town, I sense a change in attitude. They seem to be accepting the fact. As a matter of fact, now we have two Princess Anne town commissioners. A young man just won the election at large seat for the Princess Anne town by the name of Lionel Frederick, 23 years old, as a matter of fact. He beat out a veteran, a commissioner and a politician. So I can sense a change, and also the demographics of Princess Anne is changing rapidly. I think the majority population is African American. So in the future, when those individuals are educated about the political system to get involved in the voting process, we may have even more African-Americans in leadership in President Zan. But in the county, that's a difficult task, trying to change the mindset of those in the county.
Of course, this is all taking place in context, several contexts. Part of it is an economic context, and that's a big part of what Dr. Ramsey wrote about. Commissioner Mathias, tell us a bit about Somerset County's economy. What are the big employers? Where do the jobs come from? What kind of jobs?
You would have, of course, the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, ECI, which is Eastern Shore Correctional Institute, Robertset in Crisfield, and the, of course, Somerset County Board of Education. And that basically would cover the largest number of employers within the county. There is not a lot of job opportunities for persons who are residents of Somerset County. Most of the larger corporations that used to reside or employ people from the Wicomico, Worcester, and Somerset area that hire the largest number of African Americans and who pay the best salaries are no longer in the area. They have since moved. So there's not a lot of opportunity. And most of the younger persons that graduate from high school and college, they move away from the area because there are not many opportunities for them to become gainfully employed.
Dr. Hall, what do you think needs to be done?
Well, I say it's mindset. We are a diverse county, and with diverse ideas and with dreams that every child wants and opportunity they deserve. Until the county adopts that concept, we're going to stay like we are. The motto is going to stay, Semper Idem, always the same. And things, this is 2014, will not change unless other people come to the forefront of voicing this concern.
Do you see that happening?
Do I see it happening? I would hope in my lifetime that maybe hopefully God will intervene. and folk will get a vision, understand that the way we are going. And why is it that Somerset County has the highest unemployment rate in the state? Why is it our school system has been so troubled? Why is it we cannot get African-American leaders in the county? And that's some reason behind that. And until we continue to educate and keep voicing this theme of diversity, maybe, and just maybe it'll catch hold.
Dr. Kirkland Hall is chairman of the Democratic Central Committee in Somerset County and an instructor in the Exercise Science Department at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. Pastor Craig Mathias represents District 1 on the Somerset County Commission. Earlier, we heard from Meredith Ramsey, who has just published an update of her 1996 study titled Community, Culture, and Economic Development, Continuity and Change in Two Small Southern Towns. Special thanks to Chris Rank with Delmarva Public Radio for recording Dr. Hall and Commissioner Mathias at Delmarva Public Radio Studios in Salisbury. We've got more information about the book on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of these interviews there, too, including Meredith Ramsey on the founding of Somerset County and on the role of the prison, the Eastern Correctional Institute, in voting districts, and Dr. Kirkland Hall and Commissioner Mathias on the impact of the book. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning, a trip through time on Charles Street. Stay with us on 88.1.
Producer Jamila Kay. Go to our website to learn more about a segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall, and this morning I'm paying a visit to the historian and author John McCrane in his home in Towson. Mr. McCrane is the former secretary of the Baltimore County Landmarks Preservation Commission, and from 1998 until he retired in 2007, he served as the official historian of Baltimore County. He's written several books, the latest of which is a history of one of the area's most familiar and widely traversed streets, Charles Street. From its start near the city's inner harbor to its northernmost tip in Lutherville, Charles Street has a rich architectural history and a long list of famous residents, which are chronicled in John McCrane's book, Charles Street, Baltimore's Artery of Elegance. Mr. McCrane, thanks for having me over. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. We're glad to have you here.
So this project began, you say in the book, from an idea hatched in Popular Photography magazine in 1960. They suggested that folks take pictures of the main streets in their house. So did you take up that challenge?
Yes, I did. I started traveling all the length and width of Charles Street from one end to the other, taking 35-millimeter, mostly black and white photographs. There were some very interesting old residential areas in the south end of Charles Street at that time, the little federal houses with two-story brick row houses with dormer windows down around the cross street market, and they're all gone now, gone as if they had never existed.
So Charles Street begins for you exactly where? I mean, and it was not always called Charles Street when Baltimore was, before it was sort of established as what we know now as Baltimore, little Baltimore town in the 1700s. Where does it actually physically begin and end?
Well, it apparently begins near the water at the middle branch and runs northward up through the city and all the way out to Lutherville and to West Towson as it branches out. It was originally called Forest Street on the earliest maps for laying out the very small, almost a village of Baltimore. And usually the villages and towns decreed by the General Assembly were never populated by anyone. Most of these towns the General Assembly decreed failed to attract any investors or lot buyers, and they just didn't succeed whatsoever. But Baltimore Town actually took root and grew a little bit, and grain traffic is what started making Baltimore a port, and the people in Adams County, Pennsylvania, were closer to water and ship captains to whom they could sell grain products than they would be to Philadelphia. So we served the southern edge of York County as an outlet to the sea.
There are a number of famous Charleses in the history of Maryland. Which one is Charles Street named after?
Well, it was apparently in print as early as 1761, so people who say it was named for Charles Carroll of Carrollton can't be right, because he was a youth at that time, had not achieved anything. Sun paper, William Stump one time wrote that it was probably named for the fifth Lord Baltimore, Charles Calvert, who actually came here to Maryland of the proprietary family of the Calverts.
I know you're a historian of Baltimore County in particular in this area very specifically, but as you think about other cities in the United States and their main streets, what do you think it is about Charles Street that makes it unique and that makes it so fascinating to you and to many of your readers?
Well, it was the string of elegant shops, or specialty shops and things that led up to the hill, to the Washington Monument. And then there are all the great institutions strung out along Charles Street, the Cathedral, the Unitarian Church, Old St. Paul's. The Peabody Institute is at the top of the hill near the monument. And then you have three colleges along the length of Charles Street and various academies and schools. And there was at least one hospital. And then when you get out into the country, you have the great sprawling property of Shepherd Pratt, and that's been joined by the great institution of the GBMC Hospital.
Are there particular buildings, are there particular architectural features of the buildings that are scattered along this long expanse of Charles Street that are of particular interest to you as an historian?
Well, we have the Basilica downtown, such an early American building of such an enormous size. It's just remarkable that early Americans of the Republican era could have pulled off anything so big and paid for it and put a roof over it and managed to maintain it down to the present. And then you have the, as I say, the Unitarian Church attracted the Industrial Archaeology Convention goers because they wanted to see the internal arrangements of the first roof and the second roof, because it was built very elegantly of timber trusses, and the only thing wrong was that the minister couldn't be heard when he spoke, so they eventually put in a barrel vault and did away with the first dome arrangement, and the SIA visitors went up into rafters, toured all around on one of their national conventions here when it came to Baltimore. And then there's a great building of the Walters Art Gallery, Peabody with its cast iron bookshelves, and then all the great buildings farther out the road, the whole completely unified campus of the Hopkins campus with all its buildings all neatly laid out, balancing each other, following the Georgian Revival style.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. I'm here in Towson at the home of John McCrane. His latest book is called Charles Street, Baltimore's Artery of elegance. Mr. McCrane, I was interested to find out the history of many of the buildings that you write about and you show photographs of in the book. One in particular that struck me was Penn Station. What we now know as Penn Station, the train station, is actually the third iteration of the station. Talk us through the history of that particular site.
Yeah, well, the Penn Station goes back to a tremendous undertaking in the 1870s of building tunnels east of Baltimore to bring in the East Coast line of the what used to be the Baltimore and Port Deposit Railroad. It had evolved into the Pennsylvania Railroad, and at the same time, the same company was building westbound tunnels under Wilson Street going west to be able to go southwest to Washington, D.C. And those are the present bottleneck tunnels that are plaguing railroaders at the present, but they were a great achievement in their time. And the first Penn Station apparently was just a wooden structure, and there's no known close-up photograph of it. That's a great shame. We'd love to know what it looked like. You can see it as a little faraway speck in the aerial photographs of 1874 from the newly completed tower of the Presbyterian Church on Madison Street. By 1910, Baltimore needed an elegant station with lots of marble, and the one designed by Kenneth Murchison is the one we still have today, and had gotten filthy in recent years, and they apparently had blocked out the windows during World War II to keep all those enemy aircraft from finding it, and eventually it was recently cleaned, and it looks quite good, and it sits astride the tracks, and you go down. It's not like a little whistle-stop town anymore. You go down many steps to the trains, and someday we'll be able to take the maglev bullet train and get to Washington in 4 minutes.
Many of the photographs in the book are photographs that you took yourself over the years, and then many, of course, are from historic archives of various places. You write a lot about the buildings that are no longer there. You're an historian, a preservationist. Are there one or two buildings that are no longer on Charles Street that you really regret their demise, that you really wish we still have, that we made a terrible blunder in getting rid of in favor of some other newer structure?
Well, we have lost a lot of buildings. Some have been adapted for other uses, but there's the whole, I think it's 1,000 block of North Charles Street has been practically wiped out. And there was that enormous home of the Apole family, the people who made their fortunes in curing leather. They were in, I think, the 1,000 block. And they had a big, big house of the 1870s with a mansard roof and a cupola on top of that. And that's gone completely.
Do I have it right that the 1,000 block of Charles Street is in the vicinity of Chase? Is that about right?
Yeah, I think so. It's easy to get mixed up with the 1,000 and the 1,100 block. At one time, so many houses were being knocked down that Wilbur Hunter of the Peale Museum said that it looked like parking lot developers were having a vendetta against the designs of the English architect E.G. Lind.
As you see continuing construction, continuing work up and down the Charles Street corridor, I think, for example, right now, Hopkins, the Homewood campus, is the site of a massive renovation of Charles Street. They're going to change traffic patterns and pedestrian patterns, and they're going to make a lot of changes to that area. And you know, above 28th Street, between say 28th and 33rd Street on Charles Street. As you see this unfolding, what are your thoughts from your perspective as a historian?
Well, my thoughts are mostly trepidation. I don't know what they're going to do in the final analysis. I went down, I think it was early 2013, to photograph the flowering trees that had been prescribed in the Olmsted plan for those parkways to make Baltimore look like Paris. And the trees had been chopped down, so heaven knows what it's going to look like when it's finished. It may not look very good, but then again, I could be wrong.
And I have no doubt that you'll be there to document it with your camera and continue to write about it. Well, John McCrane, thank you so much for your time this morning. I really appreciate it.
Well, yeah, thank you very much, too.
John McCrane's History of Charles Street is called Charles Street, Baltimore's Artery of Excellence. We'll have a link to information about the book on our website. Come to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Reporting from Towson, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us here on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast.
Maryland Morning is an original production of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. We have production help from Brandon Block, Alexandra Kennedy, and Justina Latimer.
You can learn more about what you've heard on our show or catch something you've missed on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Oh boy, what a dance I saw down yonder in Baltimore, done to a brand new tune. In most every cabaret, from Dixie to Frisco Bay, they'll all be doing it soon. There's a dance called a black flag called Baltimore. Oh baby, that step has got a rhythm that's hot. When they start playing, then they start swaying like an old sweet saw. When you start stepping about, get up and show, hey. Now first you count the feet, you double it, then 3 feet, and then you just slide your feet right over the floor. There's a dance called a black flag, called I never did before.